Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein. Thank you for joining me for a responsum a day for the 12th of Av. Today's responsum is a little different than the usual ones because I usually find the responsum and use it. Occasionally, I don't find one that's long enough, and therefore, I'll use a few. Sometimes, I have in the past used a few from the same meshiv on different days and different occasions of that date in his life. But Rav Yosef Shaul Natanson, who was an important 19th century Rav, and who has a book of responsa called Shut Shoel Umeshiv, I recently encountered, I think for the first time-ish, and I was paying attention to it, and I noticed that he goes even further in the way that he uses date, because he will not date his tshuvot, his responsa, so much as in the course of a long responsum, we'll remember different events that happened on different dates that were related to this responsum. So in the middle of responsum, we'll say, and on such and such a date, I was doing this, and then a couple of paragraphs, and then a few paragraphs later, and on such and such a date, I was doing this, and he's very exact about his dates, about his memory of what happened when. So I thought that was interesting. So it happens to be that in three different responsa that I found in Shoel Umeshiv, he mentions the same exact date. So even though they appear in three different responsa, it's sort of like an encapsulation of the 12th of Av of 5613. 5613 was 1853. Rav Yosef Shaul Natanson in Shut Shoel Umeshiv has three different things that come up, but I thought it would be sort of a reminder of how he spent his day on the 12th of Av of 5613. So, the first of those is in Shut Shoel Umeshiv Tinyana. This is in the second version of it, in Chelek Gimel Siman Kufchet. He's in the middle of a tshuva, and we'll see what it's about in a second, but he says, it happened that in the year Tafresh Yud Gimel, 5613, which was 1853, as I said, on the 12th of Av, a man came to me and he had the following question. There was a woman who had some kind of a headache, some kind of a pain in her head, and what the doctor said she was supposed to do is to make, it's a cultness, which I had a hard time looking up, but I think it means some kind of a bun. She would braid, like a French braid or some sort like that, which she would braid her hair on top of her head or put them up together and bind them together in some way and never cut them and never shave them off or cut them or remove them. And the doctor said, it's a sakana. It's a danger to her. So the question was, what should she do about going to mikveh? She's a married woman. She needs to go to mikveh in order to be able to live with her husband in the usual marital way. What should she do about this? Because we have a halacha that women can't have this. Anybody who goes to mikveh can't have what's called a chatzitza. You can't have things that stop the water from covering the whole body. So it happens to be in the Gemara. This will be relevant to the tshuva. I'm just applying a little bit of background in the Gemara. The Gemara seems to think that the only biblical problem with chatzitza, with blockages, would be if it's on the majority of the body and the person cares about it. It's called rubo umakbid alav, that it's a majority of the body and the person cares about it and would want to remove it. But if it's mute hamakbid, it's something less than the majority of the body and it's something that would remove. So let's say somebody goes to mikveh and afterwards notices that on their arm or leg there was a leaf. And of course they would take the leaf off if they had noticed it. That would be mute hamakbid. Or rubo sheino makbid, or even if something's covering the majority of the body and the person doesn't care. So those are also make an invalidate the immersion, but that's derabanan. That is at a rabbinic level. However, this cultness is on her head. It might be the majority of her head because hair is the majority of the head, and the head might be separate from the body. So in any case, question is, how can she go to mikveh? She's got this thing. She's got a bunch of hair on her head, and she's not allowed to cut that off because the doctors say that it's a sakana, it's a danger to her. So what should she do about going to mikveh? And it's already been a year that she just hasn't gone to the mikveh. Yosef Shaul Natanson notes an earlier book of Tshuva called Panim Me'irot, an important authoritative work. Panim Me'irot had said that it was prohibited. And the reviews of Shaul Natanson says, I don't know why he was being so machmir, because even in this situation, most of the hair isn't so braided together that the water can't get through and that it's a big problem. So he says it's at most a suffix drabana. It's at most we have a doubt about whether, meaning because we said this is, it's not most of the hair, it's probably less than most of the hair, so then not most of the body, but it's not most of the hair. If it's not most of the hair, then it's mute and might be mute hamakbid, it might be mute that you care about, but even that would only be drabana, right? Or even if it's rovasarot, if it's majority, but she's not makbidah because she's not going to stop because she doesn't care about it. She wants it that way. So these would be derabbanan. So we don't know what it is. We don't know if the hair is not, if the water is not getting through. He seems to him a suffic derabbanan. It seems to him, he says, that he should be able to, she should be able to go to the mikvah the way she is. Parabi'irat had said that one of the reasons that she's not allowed to do it is also that it's not a refu'ah biduka. This is an important topic that comes up in other areas, places as well, that the doctors have claimed this provides her medical healing. Parabi'irat says we have no well-established studies, whatever the standard of his time of well-established medicine would have been. It's not a well-established medical treatment. When it's not a well-established medical treatment, then you're not allowed to rely on it the same exact ways. This is a crucial issue to think about in our times as well, as what qualifies as a well-established medical treatment, a refuah biduka, in order to allow violating certain prohibitions violating certain prohibitions or not worrying about certain prohibitions. The standard was refuah biduka. The review of Shaul Dalton says, in our case, though, it's clear that it works. Why is it clear that it works? Because it's been a year she hasn't gone to mikvah. She's been growing this hair, and she hasn't had the headaches. So, review of Shaul Dalton says, it is a refuah biduka in our case. It is a form of medical treatment that is clearly working, and therefore he thinks that it's clearly okay, and therefore she should be. And the Panimi Ira, now he can say, the Panimi he wrote was only machmir, he was only stringent about it, because he was asked there, when the doctors are predicting this, whatever it was in that case, but this is the way that she can be healed, and it wasn't a well-established medical treatment. You have this today, you have arguments with insurance companies about these things, right? A doctor will say, well, maybe this will work, and there's not enough evidence yet to support it, and insurance companies will say they don't want to pay for it. So that's the question of refuah biduka or not. So here, but he's, Rav Yosef Shaul Natanzon is saying, the Pani Meira was talking about a refuah, a form of medical treatment that had not yet been well-established. If it's not yet well-established, you can't have halachic leniencies come into play because of it, and therefore it would be an issue and you couldn't do it l'chadchila. But in our situation, she's already done the medical treatments, and the doctors have told her that if she stops, it'll be a sakana to her. So Rav Yosef Shaul Natanzon says it's at worst a chashash sakana, it's at worst a worry that maybe there's a danger to her life, and we have a halacha, even for Isurei Shabbos, even for violating Shabbat, even for violating Yom Kippur, that if you have an established suffix sakana, if you have an established possibility of sakana, that we would rely on doctors to tell us what qualifies as suffix sakana, to qualify as saving a life. And therefore, here, what the question is, removing this hair, and that would create a suffix sakana, and he says, therefore, it's obviously true that she's not makpedet ala chatzitza. She doesn't care about the chatzitza because she, at least in her mind, it's saving her life. So that means that she's not going to want to remove it. That's called not makpedet. She's not makpedet means that it's a derabbanan issue. So if we would have allowed relying on this to qualify it as a sakana for Shabbat purposes, certainly we would allow relying on it as a sakana for mikvah purposes to say that we can ignore the rabbinic prohibition here. Then he goes a step further and he says, and let's say she doesn't like the hair and she doesn't trust the doctors enough and she thinks to herself, I would take it off if anybody would let me, but my family doesn't let me, so it's really makpedet now. And it bothers her, and that changes the mikvah status of the chatzitza, of the blockage to the water getting through. Yosef Shaul Natanzon says this, he thinks it's still not a problem, because since most people in that situation who had that illness, to whom the doctor said, you are in danger and this is the treatment, would not have been makpidim, would not have been bothered by that chatzitza, that blockage on their body. Yosef Shaul Natanzon says that two is sufficient to define this chatzitza, this blockage to the water getting through, as something that people are not makpid on, even though she's explicitly being makpida. She's explicitly saying, I wish I could remove it. He thinks it doesn't matter, and her immersion in the mikvah would be valid anyway, because he has a chuta, he has a rashba that says, the rashba says that anything that people in general aren't makpid about doesn't qualify as a hakpada in terms of chatzitza for the mikvah. Now, it happens to be the Rambam and the Tur think that what she's makpida, that what she cares about, is an important, relevant question to going to mikvah, because if you think about it logically, that makes sense. If Chazal were worried about what qualifies as a blockage on a person's body, what that person thinks of as a blockage, they would definitely remove if they could, and if they noticed it, that would be blocking water from getting through, that should be getting through. But here, the reviewer's children says the reason why it would be different is because even if she is makpita, we're not going to let her. People around her are not going to let her take it off, because they all think, by virtue of what the doctors have said, that it's a possibility of sakana, of endangering her life, and therefore it's not really hakpada, meaning she doesn't like it. And in that sense, she's makbida, she's opposed to it, but it's not the kind of thing that she's going to be taking off. Because it says, what we care about for mikvah is, if there's something on the woman's body, on the person's body going to mikvah, that should be removed, and that would be removed if they knew about it, that would be a chatzitza. But here, you know about it, and you're not going to take it off, so therefore it's not a chatzitza. So for all these reasons, Rav Yosef Shlomo Zalman thinks she can go to mikvah, because the Durabanan issue is pushed aside by the Sakana issue, the question of a chatzitza or not a chatzitza, whether she's makpida or not makpida. Putting all these things together, this is the conclusion that he comes to, especially, he closes by saying, magam b'makom igun kazeh. Especially since, if she can't go to mikvah, she can't live with her husband. If she can't live with her husband, she's not going to be able to be married to him. And then Rav Yosef Shlomo says, in a phrase that comes up several many times in halachic literature, v'koshim gerushin, and it's very difficult for people to get divorced. Nowadays, people get divorced, and there are lots of reasons why people might need to get divorced, but one of the underlying ethoses of the halachic literature is always that we don't want to force people into getting divorced. Where they need to, for whatever reason, and they can't live together productively, that's a whole different discussion. But we very much want people to find a way to live together, and especially since that means also that her husband's not going to be able to have children while they're married, because she's not going to mikvah, so they can't live together. And also, she's very young, and so what? So what is that? We're worried that she will act inappropriately if she's divorced, meaning she might not wait till she got married again to do things that are inappropriate, especially in their times when people do things like that. Therefore, he concluded in this discussion that she should and could go to mikvah and stay married, and that would all work out. That was one tshuva where he mentions the 12th of Av of Tafresh Yud Gimel. The next one is in Chol Meshiv Mahadura Rivi'ah in the 4th edition. This is in Chelek Aleph Siman Nuntet, and he mentions again our date, the 12th of Av of 5613. And he's learning Avodah Zarah, Masechet Avodah Zarah, and he got to Daf Nunbet Nun Gimel, he says, Nunbet and Nun Gimel, where it says, talks there about this interesting halachic topic that I once spoke about in shul and got myself in trouble for it. In any case, different story. Can't tell it right now. But you can email me for the story if you want. My email address is grotht@gmail.com, and I'm happy to share the story with you. And please tell me if you're listening regularly, semi-regularly, if you enjoy it, what I could change, what I could improve. I'd love to hear from you in all those ways. So here's a halacha. There's a halacha called bitul of an avodah zarah. Jews aren't allowed to own avodah zarah items, whatever they are. You're not allowed to own them. We have to destroy them. But there are things that were originally an avodah zarah item and then are no longer considered avodah zarah items. That's why you find some people, and this is actually unfortunately an error, some Jews will buy things that are avodah zarah, that we think are avodah zarah, that we think non-Jews have worshipped, and they'll buy it and they'll knock off a piece of the idol, the nose, the ear, the something, and they'll say, oh, that was mevatel. That doesn't actually work, because Jews can't be mevatel avodah zarah. Jews cannot nullify items of idol worship and make them no longer items of idol worship. It's not in the power of Jews to do that. If an item of idol worship comes into the possession of a Jew, the Jew has to destroy it. What can happen is that a non-Jew can be mevatel it before it ever came to the Jew's possession. And there, you don't necessarily need to knock off an ear or anything. If the non-Jew treats it disrespectfully in certain ways, I'm pretty sure that spitting on it, if the non-Jew spits on it, that shows the non-Jew clearly can't think of it as an avodah zarah, as an idol worship, because you'd never treat something that you think of as in any kind of a deity in that kind of a way, unless that was the way to worship it, but that's a whole different discussion. So that could happen. So the Gemara there talks about the fact that a Jew can't be mevatel avodah zarah of an akum, and there's a whole discussion there that it seemed like he has a partnership with the idolater around other things or around this item, and the thought was maybe he could be mevatel the non-Jews portion of that. And Rav Yosef Shlomo says when he came across that idea that when a Jew and a non-Jew have a partnership, that's when there's a problem. That's one of the situations where there's a problem in the Jew trying to mevatel, trying to nullify the non-Jew's idolatry. He says, that reminded me of a Bach in Orach Chaim that I always had a problem with. And the Bach in Orach Chaim was, if we're talking, the discussion there is in Tuf Kuf Pei Vav, let's say you have a shofar that you want to blow for Rosh Hashanah purposes, but it's been used for Avodah Zarah. So the Shulchan Aruch there rules that if that's got owners, then even if the Jew decides to take possession of it, he doesn't own it. And that would be okay, because that would mean, therefore, that somebody else, a non-Jew, could still be mevatelet. Meaning, once a Jew takes possession of it, he can't then give it back to a non-Jew and hope for the non-Jew to be mevatelet, and therefore get him away from his problem, from his challenge. Once he owns it, then he's got a problem with it. But so the Shulchan Aruch there, Paskins, rules that if it belonged to somebody, then as long as it belongs to somebody, the Shulchan Aruch ruled, the Shulchan Aruch ruled that if the Jew picks it up, he takes possession of it, and it becomes his Avodah Zarah that he owns, even though somebody else owns it, even though the non-Jew owned it, and therefore he's not Yotzei, and you can never be Mevatelet again. The Bachet said, that doesn't make any sense. If it belongs to somebody else, then even if he meant to pick it up, he didn't take possession of it. And the Magen Avraham was bothered by the Bach there, because the Magen Avraham says, we have a Gemara that Rava says that you didn't allow certain things, so we worried that a Jew would pick it up and then be Mevatel the Avodah Zarah, and you would have thought that, and he would think that, and he would think that he had been Mevatel, that it's no longer an Avodah Zarah, when in fact is his Avodah Zarah. So the Rav Yosef Shaul Notzon says, when he was younger, as he says, B'yalduti, I don't know if Yalduti means he was a child, he was just a younger man, he says he was surprised by this. As I mentioned, his childhood, I should say that in the 12th of Av in 1853, he was around 43 years old. He was born in 1810, according to the biographies in the Baron Lan Sidi Ram. So he's around 43 years old. So he could have been when he was 20. But in any case, he said he was surprised by this Bach and this whole discussion. And he says, V'chein katavti v'gilyon ha-shulchan aruch sheli. And I wrote that in my notes on my Shulchan Aruch. A reminder that there was a time when people wrote freely in their Sfarim, and they thought of it as, it wasn't doodles, but they thought of it as part of learning with the Sefer was that the Sefer was alive for you. You wrote your own notes in the Sefer and you took notes on it in that way. So he says he expressed his surprise, because Rashi says that anything that's Hefker, that's not owned by anybody else, once you pick it up, you're Kone. So it seems like the situation where we said in the Gemara that Rava, where we said that Rava was had a gzera, lest somebody pick it up and then it would be his, and he would have thought that he could be vatalit. That's a case of hefker, and many achronim. He says he saw afterwards there were achronim who said the same thing, but now he's saying on this day in 1853 that Rava there, he realized the Magen Avraham was actually right, because Rava there was talking about a situation of shutfus, of partnership. So in that situation, you wouldn't seem to be able to take possession of it. In closing of this part of the tshuva, now it gets a little bit technical about Avodah Zarah issues that we don't have to get into fully, but he does say that he thinks that what the Bach would say is that if they're partners and the non-Jew owns part of it, then even the Jewish part doesn't become fully the Jew's. Because the Gemara says that when a Jew worships the Avodah Zarah of a non-Jew, this is an interesting insight into Jews back then, it may or may not be true today, but that when a Jew worships in Avodah Zarah, God forbid, but if a Jew is worshiping in Avodah Zarah of a non-Jew, the Jew does it al data of the Avodah Zarah, that he does it according to their rules. So if that's true, Rav Yosef Shaul Notzon doesn't suggest that what the Bach might have meant was that when the Jew picks up the Avodah Zarah to take possession of it, he might only do it al dat the non-Jew, and therefore if the non-Jew had a share in it, and the Jew never really meant to take possession of it because the non-Jew owned a share in it, and therefore it might not count as his taking possession of it. Leaving aside those technical issues, he makes one last point that is broadly relevant, which is that when we say that a non-Jew can be mevatel an Avodah Zarah, that a non-Jew can nullify an Avodah Zarah, it doesn't have to be a non-Jew who worships that Avodah Zarah. So let's suppose I'm in a flea market and I saw a Buddha, right, which many people will try to tell you that's not an Avodah Zarah, but if you wade through all of the verbiage around, it likely is, or has been certainly in the past, and then I want to be mevatelet, so I say to my friend the Catholic, you know, could you be mevatel that Avodah Zarah? Could you nullify that by treating it as if it's not a deity, and treat it in some way? Let's say knock off an ear, just for the sake of it. So you might think to yourself, why should the non-Jew, that non-Jew, be able to do anything to it? It's not his or her idol worship, and not only is it not his or her item, it's not his or her form of worship. Of course he doesn't care about it, or she doesn't care about it. The halacha is that doesn't matter. The halacha is that qualifies as a bittul. So if I wanted to own that Buddhist statue for whatever reason as a cultural artifact, and I was b'mevatel it, then I would be able to, as long as I b'mevatel it in that way. Some total for Rav Yosef Nachshon Natzon Snell, he came to new insights on this halakhic topic of this Bach that he'd been bothered by, where the Bach said that if you pick up an item, even if you mean to take possession of it, if it's an item of Avodah Zarah, as long as it has an owner, it doesn't work. So that was the whole discussion that he was getting into, and that was part of the discussion that he had about whether or not we can be mevatel Avodah Zarah, nullify items of idol worship, also part of his day on the 12th of Av of 5613. Last piece of it is Nishal Nishal, again, Mahadur Rivia in the fourth edition, the fourth way through, the fourth time he published things in his shoot. This is from part three, Siman Yud Chet, and he had gotten a question from a Rav. He calls him a Rav Acharif, a very sharp Rav Yitzchak Shmelkis, and he had the following question. There's a halacha called Kimle B'Drabamine. Kimle B'Drabamine means that if somebody is obligated or liable for two punishments, halachically, we would only give the more serious of those punishments. That's Kimle D'Rabamine. So when this Rav was asking Rav Yosef Shlomo Natzon a question, says, well, when it comes to somebody who would be theoretically obligated for malkot, for lashes in Beit Din, and also for the death penalty, for capital punishment, chayvim mitot and chayvim malkot, we say he'd be putter, he would be... And he would not get the malkot, he would not get the lashes because of Kimle D'Rabamine. So this man said, I don't understand, you don't need to have that reason, because once he's been judged for capital punishment, once his verdict has been reached, then you can't possibly obligate him in malkot, obligate him for lashes, because Rav Shimon HaTemani in the Gemara had said that in order to give somebody lashes, you need witnesses, and then you need the community to come together, and then you need to figure out how many lashes he can get and live through. And there's a whole long process there. And we generally think that with capital punishment, as soon as the verdict is reached, we're supposed to enact the verdict soon afterwards so the person doesn't sit around for a while dreading the death penalty to come. So too, he says, even with money issues, even if the person was liable for the death penalty and was convicted, and then also owed money, then you couldn't really obligate him to pay the money, because that also would delay the enactment of the capital punishment. And therefore, how could that be? According to Shimon HaTemani, then there's no question that you can't have these two punishments come together, because one of the punishments will delay the other one, and we're not allowed to delay the other one. So Rav Yosef Shlomo Natzon says it must be that we have the halacha, that his halacha came first, meaning that we first came to the verdict on the malkot, on the lashes, or the money, and then afterwards the death penalty. This is all still part of the man's question. And then he said, so it must be that what we're talking about is that they're from they're in two different issues. That the man did one thing for which one was Chayav Malkot, and a different thing was Chayav Mita. And that's what we're saying, you can't get them both because of Kimle B'Drabamine. But if they were on the same thing, there would be technically no way to get to it. Forgetting the Kimle B'Drabamine issue, forget that there's a general principle, we only give one punishment for a sin. And he's saying you don't need to come to that if it's really in the same action. That was his answer. And he thought it helped with other issues as well. Rav Yosef Shlomo Natzon says, this is a phrase that's often used to compliment another Torah scholar on his thinking, that the words of a chacham, the words of a wise man, are always have grace to them and are always wonderful. So first of all, he says, it's not such a question, because Rav Shimon HaTemani is not who we paskin like. We paskin, we rule according to the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, who held that there are ways to have them both happen if you needed to, and therefore the whole thing doesn't come up. But also, he said, I came up with a new idea. There is in the Gemara that Rava says on behalf of Rabbi Chunya ben Akana, to vote a Daf Lamed, there's a Brayta, Laf Lamed Amud Aleph, there's a Brayta to vote where Rabbi Chunya ben Akana says would make Yom HaKippurim like Shabbos in terms of Tashlumin. Meaning, if somebody violated Shabbos, we say, if they violate Shabbos and also owe somebody money for whatever they did, so we generally say, Kimle B'Drabamine, we say that the person is not liable for the payment because they're going to get the stricter penalty. So Rav Chunya ben Akana thought the same should apply to Yom Kippur, that since the person is liable for his life, because Yom Kippur is a karet, now that's important to know, because that means that the person's not actually going to get the death penalty that we know of from a court. They're going to get karet from Hashem. But Rabbi Chunya ben Akana said, same thing though. They're going to lose their life whether by people or by Hashem, and therefore they're patur min hatashlum, and therefore they don't have to pay any monetary penalties that come along. That's an interesting claim by Rav Yechonya ben Akada, because it means he's saying that when we say you don't pay when your life is forfeit, we don't mean when your life is forfeit in human terms. We mean as long as we have reason to believe that the perpetrator's life is forfeit, there would be no payment there. So where does he get it from? So on Amud Bet, Rava explains that the reason for Rav Yechonya ben Akada is there's a verse in the Torah that talks about Molech worship. Verse of the Torah says, if the family or the people around a Molech worshiper ignore when the worship of Molech in the time of the Torah was that they would put their children through fire. It's a debate among the commentators as to whether they would burn their children to death or they would just pass them through the fire, and that was a form of worship to the Molech. Whichever one it was, the Torah says, if people are worshiping Molech and other people don't bring them to justice for it, right? Don't enforce Torah law on them. So this is the obligation of bystanders and of the community to object and to oppose evil in their midst. So the Torah says, "V'samti ani et panai b'yishahu." Hashem says that I will take care of it, and I will not only punish that man or the person who did it, I will punish that whole community or all the people who ignored it as well. So Rava says that in saying this, Hashem is equating, according to Rabbi Yechonya ben Akada, Hashem was equating karet with mitad beitin, because apparently Hashem says, if you refuse to administer the death penalty, I'll administer the death penalty. That seems to be an equation. So Rabbi Yechonya ben Akada said, once I have an equation, he thinks that applies to also questions of kimle b'drava mine, as to whether one would have to pay a monetary fine that is incurred in the course of violating these prohibitions that come with a form of the death penalty. So Rabbi Yisrael Nutzen points out that if that were really true, if we really accepted that, then that should be true of Malkot as well, because Rava himself in Sanhedrin had held that in some sense, Malkot b'makom mita omed, that Malkot substitute for some kinds of the death penalty in some ways, meaning that Rava seems to have held, and this I think we do accept as a halachic perspective, that when somebody is given Malkot by a court, if some crime, if some sin is treated by the Torah as being worthy of Malkot, that Rav is saying, really that sort of means it was worthy of the death penalty, just the Torah chose not to administer the death penalty for it, because Malkot b'mkom mita omed, because Malkot really stand in for the death penalty. And Rashi says there that Malkot are gamke inyan mita, there's a death penalty aspect to them. If that's true, then you should say, if that's fully true, then it would mean that there's halacha in terms of chayve mito, if people are liable for the death penalty, that even if they do it unwittingly, they also won't pay. Meaning, when we say kimle b'drava mine, that we only give the greater, stricter punishment, it's not always true that it's only when we actually administer the stricter punishment. In terms of chayve mito, let's say somebody violates Shabbat, and they don't realize that it's Shabbat, or they don't realize that whatever action they're doing violates Shabbat, and at the same time, they damage somebody else's property, so they owe them money, we would still say they don't pay the money. This is an odd halachic thing to think about and to learn and to study in depth, but this is the way the halacha theoretically and fundamentally works. If they came to court and they said, well, I violated Shabbos, that means had I done it on purpose, I would have been liable for the death penalty. There too, the court will not obligate that person to pay. Of course, that person could realize they should pay because they damage this person, but they're not liable to pay in that situation. If that were true of Chayve Mitot, and now we say that Malkot stand in, that flashes are in some sense a Mita, a death penalty kind of a thing, it should be the same thing true there. And that's actually Machloket of Yochanan Reish Lakish, and therefore he says, Chayve Karet, he doesn't think that we pass like Rabbi Yehuda ben Yechonya ben Akada. Rabbi Yehuda ben Akada thought that Karet counted in this way as well. If Karet is going to count this way, then Malkot should count this way. And Rabbi Yossi Sholotus says, he doesn't think we pass in this way. This is not the way the halakhic system works. And therefore, and especially not for Malkot, because in Malkot we for sure try to make sure the person is alive afterwards, and therefore he thinks the whole discussion would move in a different direction. So you have three different experiences of Rav Yosef Shlomo Nachman on the same day in Jewish history, on the 12th of Av of Tav Reish Gimel of 1853. Rav Yosef Shlomo talking about whether a medical treatment is considered proven in terms of counting something as a sakan nefashot to allow a woman to go to mikvah even though she has what would ordinarily be considered a blockage to the mikvah water getting through her whole body. Then you had a discussion of avodah zarah issues and what a person who can and cannot be mevatel, nullify an idolatry, and when Jews can or cannot take possession of an item of idol worship. And then finally, we had the whole discussion about whether or not where being obligated for karet counts in terms of yes or no paying for an obligation incurred at the exact same time. This is Rav Yosef Shaul Natanzon, Shu'ut Mo'el, Shaul Meshiv, for the 12th of Av, Tafresh Gimel. Have a great day.